www.themouthmagazine.com.
In a recent edition of The Mouthcast, Lloyd Cole described ABC's 1982 debut album, The Lexicon of Love, as one of the greatest records ever made. Once you've heard it, it would be churlish, if not impossible, to disagree. It's an immersive record, warm, romantic, escapist, but with some real steel in the writing too. Perhaps unsurprising when you consider that the songs were forged on the streets of industrial Sheffield during the early years of Thatcherism. A masterclass in detailed production courtesy of Trevor Horn and lush orchestration by Anne Dudley have elevated this great set of songs to iconic status. In this edition of The Mouthcast, we look back at The Lexicon of Love with ABC frontman Martin Fry. What better way to celebrate 150 editions than by saying, Martin Fry, welcome to The Mouthcast.
Hi, Steve. What an honour to be here on the 150th. Thank you very much.
It's something about which you no doubt get asked all the time, The Lexicon of Love.
I've had a long and illustrious career, so with a lot of episodes and adventures. With The Lexicon of Love, it was obviously the first album, debut album for ABC, way back in 82 that came out.
Yeah. Well, I saw you play The Lexicon of Love in full with an orchestra and Anne Dudley 5 or 6 years ago, quite fittingly in Sheffield, actually. And it was incredibly uplifting to hear this great record given, well, maximum respect, really, is the only way to put it. It sounded fantastic. I guess back in its own time when you played live, it would be quite difficult to reproduce the sound of the record on stage.
We set out on a tour around the world, left Sheffield kind of in 1982 and came back in 1983. And I think we did about 80 shows, but we had a 17 piece on stage. Yeah, we had 4 or 5 violins and a cello and then the band and a couple of keyboards. And we augmented in order to kind of showcase The Lexicon of Love back then. People kind of remember The Lexicon of Love as having more strings than it actually had. Originally, with a record, it's a record with songs like Poison Arrow, Look of Love, All in My Heart. There were a couple of string sessions at the time. Anne Dudley arranged the strings. Trevor Horn produced. Gary Langan was the engineer. We generally developed the sound, really. We kind of put some pizzicatos on the Look of Love. All of My Heart had... Actually, when we came to do All of My Heart, it was originally a bit like a sort of country and western song. Trevor Horn said, I want to put a big orchestra on it. It's got quite a big section. And I remember him giving me like a sort of IOU to say that it would get to number one if it had the strings. And there was a big debate about whether or not there was an orchestra on, say, Bridge Over Troubled Water. There was a real subtlety in the arrangement. So I remember that as the album developed. But years later, it felt right to kind of bring it on at home and to play those songs. We played a show at the Albert Hall, and more recently we've been touring with the South Bank Sinfonia. So it made sense to have the band, the arrangements. We went back to the songs, and Anne Dudley put together some arrangements that sort of enhanced what we were doing back in 82. And in a funny kind of way, yeah, it did feel like bringing it back home. It wasn't like kind of, let's get in a room with an orchestra and like we're the cherries on top of a blancmange or something, you know. Yeah. Like it didn't really quite fit. It really did gel. So that's why we're doing the shows in November, backed by public demand.
Well, Lakes Kind of Love is often referred to as a kind of benchmark for orchestrated pop.
Yeah.
When you were writing the songs, could you hear all of that grandiosity in your head, or did it end up on the record as a consequence of meeting Anne?
Yeah. Back then, the climate for bands kind of post-punk, you know, it was like Joy Division and The Cure and I suppose early Dexys, Peru Boo, Magazine. But we wanted to kind of embrace a world of disco with all those Norman Whitfield productions, precision and confidence in the playing and funk and soul disco. So we were trying to marry up Chic with the Sex Pistols, or I think Duran Duran had that as their byline years later, but ours was definitely something very similar. I remember at the time when we were making the album, we definitely wanted to, I used to say to Trevor, we want to do it like Frank Sinatra was making a record now in 82. What would he do? What contemporary instruments would he use? So we had Fairlight. We had a lot of technology. You know, we were using the sort of state-of-the-art technology to make our record. But there was something older. There was a kind of older sort of pulse beat there. I was very impressed by the songwriters that worked alongside Sinatra and Nat King Cole and people like that. We wanted to bring the sort of 30s and 40s back. There's a lot of influences, really.
And Trevor Horn's production, it's impossible to calculate, really, quite how much that served the songs. It gave the album a kind of panoramic feel. There was a lot of detail in there.
Yeah, it was the first album Trevor Horn produced outside of the Buggles, so he had a lot to prove, I guess. You'd have to speak to him and his memories and his recollections and his perspective on it all. But everybody was pointing in the right direction, in the same direction. We were all very focused. Years later, Trevor's reputation grew, you know, to the point where he's like an auteur. He's like a sort of, like a film director, like Orson Welles or something, you know, a go-to guy that would conjure everything up. But back then he was the boss, but it was definitely his team. So Anne Dudley was there. She's a brilliant pianist, and she was a great arranger. She is a great arranger, always will be. Gary Langan, JJ, had a full understanding of the Fairlight. Mark White on guitar, Stephen Singleton on sax. David Palmer, the drummer in ABC at the time, he plays with Rod Stewart now. You know, he's kind of a world-class drummer. Actually, David was really into programming. We got hold of a Lindrum. We hadn't seen anything like that before. So he was really brilliant at programming and playing alongside, you know, with live hats and all the stuff you can do on a laptop now. But back then, it was kind of revolutionary, yeah, to be using those processes. So a lot of experimentation went into it, really, in a funny kind of way. And a lot of ambition. You know, at the same time, we're just a bunch of guys from Sheffield who were signing on the dole. You know, a lot of it was wish fulfillment, and a lot of it was, like, massively ambitious, really. The thinking. We'd already had a sort of top 20 hit with Tears Not Enough, so we were very ambitious, yeah. It never stood still. So when it came to record Poison Arrow, expectations were high, yeah.
It's always sounded to me like a record made by an extremely ambitious band, an extremely confident band, a band in full command of their destiny, I suppose, but also absolutely taking all of their chances.
Yeah.
Now, we spoke earlier this morning, actually, and before this call, and you mentioned that Trevor Horn had said to you when you were recording the album that it was going to be an extremely important record and that you absolutely had to get it right.
He was experienced. You know, he'd made Video Killed the Radio Star. Also, he'd produced Dollar. He'd done a couple of Dollar incredible tracks. That's why we contacted him. We'd heard Handheld in Black and White and Mirror Mirror, I think, was out. Give Me Back My Heart was just coming out. They were like panoramic sort of widescreen sound, and you could hear the ambition in it. So that's why we approached him to produce us, yeah. But he turned around to me and he said, like, listen, you've got to remember that when you make a record, it lasts forever. So take it as far as you possibly can. You can either, if you want a clarinet on it, you're going to have to spend 5 to 10 years learning to play that thing or get somebody in to play it. and put it up there in front of the camera. It was like making a movie, definitely. But at the same time, you know, we didn't really want to make a bland sort of overproduced. That wasn't our background at all. As I say, you know, we were coming out of the sort of post-punk world of, you know, the Enemy and, how can I put it? It was kind of what would Joe Strummer do? You know, that was kind of a guiding light. Or we were kind of conscious of other bands of our age, our generation, like, you know, Duran Duran, I suppose. I can't remember if they'd put a record out. When you're in a band, you live in a bubble, as you probably know. You know, it's like people create their own little universe. But our contemporaries, I suppose, was Stimulin and Funkapolitan and Heck at 100. There were rumors, you know, that there were these other bands out there trying to kind of get the alchemy of funk and pop. You know, it's kind of, I don't know why, it was just in the air, you know, back then.
Well, I had a conversation quite recently with somebody about The Lexicon of Love and also Duran Duran's Rio. And this person had really lived through the punk years as a teenager in his, you know, his late teens. And he really dislikes both of those records because he felt they were against the spirit of punk or something. But I think they're both kind of direct reactions to what was going on politically, really. This was the era of Thatcher, the early part of Thatcher's reign, and these two records were fantastic escape hatches, really.
Well, what is punk? I mean, I grew up, I went to the Leicester Free Trade Hall and saw the Pistols and the Buzzcocks, Johnny Thunders, and then at the Electric Circus, the Anarchy Tour in Manchester, Salford, and I'd followed a Clash around. I love punk rock, you know, Richard Hell in the New York, Richard Hell and the Voidoys and Patti Smith and Television, you know, The Prefects and Subway Sect, Susie and the Banshees, all that stuff. But when it came to something like the Pistols and Anarchy, it was self-expression. I didn't want to make a band that was like, you know, sort of safety pins and a fake mohairs and a fake sort of punk thing. I think a lot of people were misguided. It was kind of what it said to me and to Adamant and Simon Le Bon and countless other, Kevin Rowland, probably Robert Smith, Phil Oakey, countless other people that were coming through. It was all about self-expression and to be as original, to run against the grain. So that's what was happening. That's what we were doing. You know, we were going to jumble sales and putting together, you know, that's what wearing a gold lamé suit was all about back then.
You didn't find that at a jumble sale, though, did you?
No, that made up. But most of the other stuff we wore was, yeah, originally, yeah, yeah. And the whole New Romantic thing definitely came out of that whole world, definitely, yeah. But at the same time, it was about being as innovative as you could possibly be and finding your own voice and beating to your own rhythm. So I kind of left the punk thing behind in 1979, definitely. And living in Sheffield as well, it was really radical. You know, you'd walk down the street and you could hear Cabaret Voltaire, and the early Human League were revolutionary. Clock DVA, Comps Angels, countless bands, you know. So it was always about experimentation. It wasn't really about just following a punk blueprint, you know what I mean? That would have been a con.
And you grew up in Manchester, but moved to Sheffield.
I moved over to Sheffield, yeah, for college. So I was like living in Sheffield, sort of 77. When I got there, it was very different to Manchester. Yeah, it felt the musical climate was very different. Kraftwerk played there, and it was like it blew everybody's minds. That's a sort of simplification of what went on. But it always felt like to the left of everything. You know, it was a socialist republic of Sheffield. You could get around town on a bus for 10p forever. You could sleep on a bus. So it was kind of great because you didn't need a lot of money. It was a great environment for artists and bohemians, penniless fools like myself, to kind of form a band and try and get involved in music.
Do you remember being a particularly kind of going out person in Sheffield?
Yeah, I didn't really have anywhere interesting to live. So yeah, I was out. We'd go down to Penny's Disco on Wednesday nights and the Leadenhall happened later, I think, The Limit on a Monday night. Yeah, there were places to go out. There's a definite community of bands. So it meant when we played, originally, the whole audience was guys in bands. That was the toughest gigs we ever played, scrutinising the early ABC. You know what I mean? And so, again, that really made us kind of rebel, trying to do the opposite of what people expected of you. There was definitely that. And being in Yorkshire, I think there's a real strain of, sort of Mardy strain of... going against the grain, doing what people least expect of you. And all of that combined to turn ABC into a shiny pop moment. Yeah, definitely. I can't speak for Duran Duran, but I think a similar thing was happening there too. Yeah. they didn't grow up on yachts. They pursued their... there's an element of wish fulfillment, I think. And that was so important back then when there were three TV channels and there was very little hope for a whole generation. It was kind of a pretty ignored generation. There wasn't a lot of work. There wasn't a lot of much going on in the late 70s, early 80s. And I think it's just a cry for help, all those peacocks and that loud presentation. And same with the music.
When I accepted this job, I was resigned to my fate. When I got there early, she'd arrive late. You can say she's gone forever, or just sit tight and wait. She said I was unprincipled, that I was not the first. Like the Phoenix coming back from the ashes. I know what's good, but I know what trash is. In the headlights and the highlights of her head.
Well, it's a very romantic sounding record, The Lexicon of Love. It's quite feminine, despite the sort of sophisticated kind of James Bond qualities almost.
Yeah.
But there is some real steel in there too. And that sort of contrast, that conflict even, gave it a massive depth, I think. You know, an album of love songs could easily be trite, couldn't it?
I thought Ian Curtis was kind of quite romantic. You know what I mean? His lyrics, and they were very dark and gothic sometimes, but Sinatra. There's a lot of stuff floating around, but again, you know, we didn't want to write songs about, used to say at the time, electric pylons and a fake modern age. I wanted to write songs, love songs, and also make, say, Poison Arrow or Look of Love operatic. Something emotional and dramatic had to happen over those 3-4 minutes. So that's why they kind of climax and descend and rise again musically. You know, there's a lot of contrast within the music. It's kind of quite feverish, and that's what it's like when you're in love or when you're out of love. I think it's an experience everybody's been through if they're infatuated with somebody. It's a really raw experience, and it's not Moon in June and simple or like on a birthday card or something. You know, it's something much, much more intense. That was what I was trying to convey as well. Yeah, I think that a lot of other people felt the same way, still do in a funny kind of way, yeah.
And there's something really beautiful about all of that on The Lexicon of Love, but it's also quite arch. There are a couple of spoken word moments.
Yeah.
There's a bit on The Look of Love where you sing, when your girl has left you out on the pavement, and a female voice replies, goodbye.
There's a couple of spoken sections in The Look of Love, as I remember, and in Poison Arrow, I thought you loved me, but it seems you didn't care. The reply is, I care enough to know I never loved you. Well, that's straight out of Humphrey Bogart movie, isn't it? You know, or the one I imagined in my head, you know. I love those films where people in the 40s, where they just kind of throw lines like that at each other all the time. The girl, and it's Karen Clayton, who was the receptionist at Psalm East, the recording studio, yeah. And although it's quite a glamorous record, it was a tiny studio underneath a wig shop on Brick Lane. Now, Brick Lane today is quite a kind of trendy environment, but back then it was quite a tough old street, yeah, back in the early 80s, yeah. I'm trying to think. I did a lot of talking to myself on that record. Sometimes there'd be spaces to fill in the arrangements. We were very anti-guitar solo, so I'd have to come up with something. And when we did The Look of Love, we were in Good Earth Studios. We recorded wherever we could get free time, really. Everything happened very quickly, and we were on the run making the record. David Bowie came down to the studio because he'd been doing Baal in town, and he'd also Tony Visconti on the studio. But he came in and he said that we should have a section where a guy's leaving a message on an answering machine, which is a great idea, you know, just constantly leaving messages on a machine for somebody who's never going to pick up. But in the end, I just did a sort of stream of consciousness. Hello, it's Martin. Maybe one day you'll find true love, which I kind of got from Iggy Pop, Turn Blue. And I think he got it from James Brown, who would always just talk to himself all the time on his own records. If he had nobody else to talk to, he would kind of have an internal Shakespearean dialogue. It's all a bit theft, though, a bit staged. So there was always the scenery. I'm trying to bring that into the record too, I guess. Yeah.
The
cover. Then you judge the look by the lover. I hope you'll soon recover. Me, I go from one extreme to another. And my friends just might ask me, they say, Martin, maybe one day you'll find true love. I say maybe, but there must be a solution to the one thing, the one thing.
Well, the sophisticated image, gold lamé suit and the glamour and all of that, the attention that the Lexicon of Love has received over the years, is it a record that you've ever felt the need to get away from?
I mean, no. I mean, with ABC, we made a lot of good records, you know, different records. And the rest of the period was like, up to the present day, is definitely experimentation. I was listening back and with Alphabet City. We made Beauty Stab, which was much kind of harsher. We walked away from the sort of Lexicon Love. We made a record which was kind of much more like a rock band, a protest band. And then we went and did a Zillionaire, which was very electronic EDM before EDM kind of record. But these were all conscious efforts. And then back to kind of R&B, I suppose, and Blue Eyed Soul for Alphabet City and a house album up. But I don't know. No, not really. As soon as you kind of release something, it's public property. There was a sense then that that task had been completed in that moment in time and it was time to do something else, experiment with something else.
So I always thought Beauty Stab was a really bold record. I thought it was a good reaction to the Lexicon of Love and maybe even to the first flush of fame.
It was a reaction to the times as well, and travelling all around the world and coming back to Sheffield and seeing it and thinking, it looks medieval. You know, it's kind of like tougher. The lives of a lot of people, the times were getting hard, 83, 84, I guess. In retrospect, that's what an Andrew Marr would tell you if he looked, you know, did a historical study of what was going on in Britain at the time. You know, we were trying to reflect what was going on. But with the Lexicon of Love, I've enjoyed playing it, and it's a joy to play it in its entirety too, because the songs kind of layer into each other in a way. That's good. I've been writing new songs to do kind of a follow-up based on what happened now and where I'm at now, to do an orchestrated album with Anne. And at the moment, yeah, about sort of pretty close to finishing writing that. Lexicon of Love Part 2.
Oh, that's interesting. So the kind of protagonist in that drama, will he be looking back at his younger self from the Lexicon of Love? From middle age, will he be...
In his 50s, like me.
You know, getting in touch with the girl that broke his heart and all of that.
Yeah, reflecting on those years, on the present and the future. Yeah, definitely. To do a kind of collection of songs that kind of partly about walking down the street and meeting yourself from way back when, but also a collection of songs that work off each other. 10 Below Zero and The Beautiful Truth. The Lexicon of a Lost Ideal is another song. 60 Seconds Later, I'm just looking at a list. Kiss Me Goodbye. Flames of Desire. Yeah, it's about the kind of the dynamic of growing older.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shortly after the Lexicon of Love, around about the time of Beauty Stab, I think, you discovered that you had cancer.
Actually, no. Round about the time of How to Be a Millionaire, How to Be a Zillionaire, I discovered that I wasn't feeling great. By then, I was on the like international pop star itinerary. You know, I was playing Solid Gold in the States, which is their Top of the Pops, and on Soul Train, you know, performing some of the songs of Zillionaire. How to Be a Zillionaire was our biggest record in America, really, when I think back. It wasn't that successful here, but in Britain, but it was like Pop Be Near Me and How to Be a Millionaire, Vanity Kills were big hits there. So I was kind of full on. But then I was diagnosed with having Hodgkin's disease and had to stop work, really. Yeah. I was 27 and I was kind of stopped in my tracks, and I had to have chemotherapy. Went up to Sheffield to have the radiotherapy and then had an operation. There was a kind of period where at the time I didn't know what was going on. And I have to say, 30 years ago was different to how you can treat the Hodgkin's disease now in present day, you know, advances of modern science. But it was a really, really tough time, yeah. It was tough for a lot of different reasons, yeah.
When you face your own mortality like that, particularly for you in that moment as a pop star, I wondered whether everything else became inconsequential, you know, all of the success and all of that, or whether that was actually a huge motivator, you know, I've kind of achieved this and I'm not letting go of it.
I mean, you're sitting in a room and the doctor's explaining your medical condition and the walls are coming in and the ceiling's dropping down on your head. You are staring into the jaws of death, I'm afraid. There's no other way of putting that. But you can fight those diseases, yeah, and they're very treatable for your friend's benefit. Yeah, definitely. I went through all of those processes and came out the other side. Yeah, I'm 57 years old now. You know what I mean? I'm healthier than I've ever been before. But in that period, yeah, it was bleak. I had to face a lot of my demons and vanities. And it's tough, you know, it's tough on my girlfriend who became a wife, Julie, and it was tough on my, in retrospect, on my parents and, you know, and Mark White and the other guys in the band. They must have been terrified. But me, it's kind of like you just stay in the eye of the hurricane and get on with it, you know what I mean? And get fit and try and get healthy. We came back. I remember being in New York and I just collapsed, you know, and had to come home. So I had the treatment in the UK and then I just went underground, you know. I didn't really want to face the world and tell them all about it. But carried on working. Yeah, I got married and then came back off honeymoon and went straight into the studio and we cut Alphabet City, the fourth ABC album. And when I listen to it now, so a song like When Smokey Sings was a big, big tune for us, but it's about the power of music and how it restores you and makes you feel good. Smokey Robinson, The Miracles and Motown, how uplifting music can be. It's like a modern drug, this idea that music could ease the pain. But there are other songs on the album that are tough, really. It was kind of getting quite dark. There's a song called Archangel, which is about, I don't know, it's just a dark song. And a song called Bad Blood. When you're writing songs, you just have to write about where you're at. You can't really fake it. So I don't think a lot of those ideas were the ideal pop fodder, you know, pop subjects. But, you know, they just have, the songs, you just have to write them some days. But ironically, it's a very upbeat album, you know, and it's an album that sold a lot as well. It was great to come back and be successful once again. Yeah, very much so. Successful artistically and successful by selling a few records. Yeah.
You talk about the power of music there, and I wonder how it feels for you, because The Lexicon of Love is such an iconic record, such a popular record to this day. You know, it means a lot to people. You must hear that all the time, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good thing, though. I mean, like I say, it's public property music. You don't own it. I don't own it. I'm just a small part of it. I just contribute to it. You know what I mean? As soon as you make a hit record, it's public property. I have no problem with that. I like that.
And having seen that show a few years ago where you played The Lexicon of Love, it's a real celebration for everybody in the audience. It's very special. How is it for you?
It feels good. It's a good feeling. There's always a lot to explore in the songs. At the point when it stops being fun on stage, I stop doing it. But there is also an audience that's enjoying us reinterpret parts of that record in a good way. You know, I always want to stay close to the script of the original record, definitely. I don't like it when people come along and embellish what they're doing with a load of arrangements, you know, that are just from a different sort of period. So it is good to play that album on stage, yeah. The show is like a two-hour show, so it does encapsulate When Smokey Sings and the other songs, How to Be a Millionaire. But it is great to play The Lexicon of Love in its entirety, yeah, like a stage play, yeah.
Great. I look forward to seeing it again, Martin, and... Well, thank you very much for being the guest on this 150th edition of the Mouthcast, Martin Fry.
Cheers, Steve. Thank you.
Upon a star, if that might help. The stars collide if you decide. Wish upon a star, if that might help. What's it like
www.themouthmagazine.com.